Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Good afternoon and welcome to an encore presentation of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. The House Select Committee investigating the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6, 2021, has interviewed hundreds of witnesses and made several criminal referrals to the Justice Department for witnesses who have refused to appear before the committee. Meanwhile, hundreds of rioters have been indicted and many imprisoned for their role in the attempt to subvert democracy. A federal jury in Charlottesville, Virginia, found 12 defendants and 5 organizations liable for $26 million in damages stemming from the Unite the Right rally in 2017. Did the mob that stormed the Capitol simply coalesce around the fantasy that the election was stolen from Donald Trump? What effect do monetary verdicts and criminal penalties have on the neo-Nazi and white supremacist organizations who are behind this tragic, deadly violence? Can the roots of extremist violence be traced back to rage about the government that began in the 1970s? Today, we'll listen back to a conversation I had in December of 2021 with Dr. Kathleen Belew. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago, where she is also the faculty affiliate at the Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture. She is the author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. And along with Ramon Gutierrez, she's the editor of a collection of essays called A Field Guide to White Supremacy, in which she and other first-rate scholars explore how different forms of white supremacy and hatred manifest in events like those that took place on January 6th and extend to domestic partner violence, homophobia, transphobia, Islamophobia, anti-immigration, and anti-Semitism. The authors chronicle how hate groups have moved from the fringe to the mainstream, and they send a clear warning that the violence we've seen in recent years may well be repeated. Kathleen Belew joined us on our digital line from Chicago. Because our conversation was recorded earlier, we can't take any calls or online comments today. So you describe your work as studying the history of the present. On a certain level, that seems like an oxymoron. What do you mean by that?
Well, I thank you for the question. The history of the present is something that's come up a number of times over the years among historians and other scholars who are interested in what the study of the past can tell us about the future. But my methodology draws from studies by scholars like Lisa Lowe, who have argued that we have a bigger job to do than that. It's not just about mapping and contextualization, although those things are important. It's also about how the study of the past can show us possible courses of action and possible outcomes that we might not have imagined possible. So in other words, it's about how we can expand the idea of what is in bounds as the set of solutions that we might consider together.
And you talk about broadening our shared imaginary. That's an interesting term. I'm not quite sure I understand what it means. You say that the history of present isn't just about decoding or explaining, but it's about creating this space for new courses of action and broadening this way we approach it. Give us an example, if you could, about what that would entail.
Sure. So things like what is possible in the context of our current political system, we often think of these as hardened categories, as rules that can't be broken. But what history shows us, even if you go back 50 years, is that many of these systems were invented and can therefore be uninvented. Historians like to think about this as contingency or the possible course of events, the road not taken, the near misses. And they tell us a whole bunch of things about the ways that, you know, it's easy to look at our current political tangle and see it as locked in and inexorable, when in fact many of these problems result from systems that we have made ourselves. One of these is whiteness. And the defense of white supremacy is, I think, now familiar to most people. But one of the things we study in history is the way that whiteness itself has been constructed by people over time with very permeable and confusing boundaries around it. It's not a category that we just sort of have as a absolute. It's one that we've built, which means that there's a lot of room for thinking about how we can unmake the violent defense of whiteness.
That's an absolutely really important point. And it's interesting to me that this series of, or this collection of essays about the various dimensions of white supremacy begins with a critique of the AP style guide. The Associated Press, which is sort of the Bible that journalists use and scholars use often to, have some sort of commonality about phrases that people use and terminology that people use. But you write that scholars and journalists often use completely different language to discuss the same social problems, and you then proceed to list a number of terms, and you talk about those terms and whether or not you think that those are appropriate or not. How did that happen? how do people get to the point where they're using different language, but they're talking about the same stuff?
Yes. So the AP style book includes, as you've mentioned, everything from sort of run-of-the-mill things like, are we going to say Kim Kardashian or are we going to say Kim Kardashian West, to highly charged things like, do we capitalize the word black, which I think folks might be familiar with as an issue that newsrooms have been taking up in the last year or so. And these things have been issues in the academy as well. Less we talk less about Kim Kardashian than journalists do, but we talk quite a bit about race and immigration and gender and the way that language demarcates treatment of these topics. So in some cases, historians simply have some information that journalists need to have. So for instance, there are multiple centuries of violence that tell us that when we describe an incoming group of immigrants as a horde or a swarm, or in ways that make these processes seem overwhelming, like a tide or a flood or a wave, we know that increases in that kind of language correlate with incidences of racial violence against immigrant populations. So that's a very a quick one to resolve. We can simply say in a style book, please be aware that if you're using this kind of language, it can have this kind of impact. And here is the scholarly literature that shows us how that works. So some of it is simply about making those connections more known to the practitioners who are using that language in their daily reporting. Sometimes it's a little bit more complex. And one thing I noticed in doing the press for Bring the War Home, which was in its final stages of copy edits when the Unite the Right rally happened in 2017 and the book came out then shortly afterward, is that a lot of what I was doing after Charlottesville, after the many incidents of racial violence that followed after January 6th, a lot of what I was doing was simply explaining the terminology and how we ought to describe what people were seeing based on historical scholarship. And at some point, I picked up the Associated Press style book, and I noticed that there were long sections about Al-Qaeda, about ISIS, even a paragraph, a standalone definition about the Irish Republican Army, which has not lately been in our headlines. And then there was hardly anything about the white power movement. There was nothing about the Klan, nothing about neo-Nazism. There was a small and outdated section about the alt-right that was already not usable anymore because of the way that the movement had evolved. And journalists were going out into these stories, into the field, without even the basic information about what language to use when you're thinking about these groups, much less the complex set of ethical questions around what kinds of stories are most likely to amplify this problem versus cast public attention in such a way that we might more coherently confront it.
If you've just joined us, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Dr. Kathleen Ballou from the University of Chicago. She is a co-editor of a incredibly provocative and very elucidatory collection of essays called A Field Guide to White Supremacy, and we're talking about it here today on Midday. And with your indulgence, Dr. Ballou, I'm going to ask you to do some defining of terms, because you write in your essay the distinctions between white nationalism, white supremacy, white power. So I do want to talk about that. But the first thing I want to mention, just as a kind of an aside, is in this chapter about the AP style book, you say that the term Caucasian is an outmoded term based on pseudoscience, and we urge journalists not to use it. You making any progress in that regard? What do you think?
I actually don't see that word as much as I used to. Caucasian, for those who have not studied the history of race and racialization, comes from the sort of Linnaean classification of races that dates to the early 1800s and is sort of the beginning of the idea that whiteness is somehow biologically superior or culturally superior to other races. This has been widely debunked, and it goes, you know, we can trace a direct line from things like the word Caucasian to pseudosciences like phrenology, which is the measurement of head size as a way of predicting quote-unquote superiority of race. There's a whole constellation of things that go along with this that have been documented in the historical scholarship. But it's one of those things that Caucasian is sort of the word that still lurks out there as a scientific definition, when in fact we know that it is not a scientific definition. It is a socially constructed definition. So I think the more we can be aware of that, the better.
Yeah, let's just hope that it finds its way off of the forms that people have to check, you know, when you're checking your race.
There is an incredible digital art project that people can look up if they're interested by Josh Begley, who's a digital artist, so you can see all of this right from your computer. But he has a piece called Race Box, which is simply, what has that question looked like throughout the life of the U.S. Census when you're asked to describe yourself? And it changes quite a bit over time, as you might think. For instance, are we going to count Hispanic Latino as a race or as an ethnicity or not count it at all? How are we going to think about whiteness or other kinds of groups? All of these things change quite a bit over American history. And people might be aware that a lot of groups that we think of as white today, like Irish, Polish, and other ethnic categories who arrived in the United States mostly in the late 1800s, were not always thought of as white, and were only incorporated in the early 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose taken in that prism, you can say that some progress has been made, but the progress, of course, is pretty slow in a lot of ways. So let me ask you about these distinctions between some of the terminology like white power and white supremacy. You say that these should not be confused, those two particular terms. What is the distinction that you draw?
So I think it helps to use an analogy, and this will be a little bit sloppy, but if people can bear with me a second. I think it helps to think about white supremacy as a big wooden fence that is impeding our route to inequality should we wish to make that journey together as a country. The big wooden fence, parts of it were put up a long time ago by people who believed in white supremacy. But it has many different planks, only one of which is what we might think of as racial violence, which includes white power activism. Other planks include other mechanisms that continue to ensure inequality in our society. So these planks include, but are not limited to, educational outcomes, rates of incarceration, rates of prosecution, maternal fetal health outcomes. There's all kinds of measures where we can see that our society simply does not operate equally by measure of race. Now, a lot of these are still in place because people are making white supremacist policy-making decisions. But if we were all right now to simply stop valuing white supremacy, it wouldn't be enough to just walk away from the problem, because this fence was put up a long time ago and there it still stands, even when individual belief is absent. So one way to think about this is an event that I write about at length in Bring the War Home, which was the coordinated shooting of leftist demonstrators in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1979 by Klan and neo-Nazi gunmen. Now, this is an act of political and racial violence Four of the people killed were white men who were leftist organizers in the community, and one was an African-American woman. So we have the act of violence. White power activism explains the act of violence. But then we have this other story, which is about these guys who carried out the shooting, although it was captured on news camera, were acquitted at state trial, acquitted at federal trial, and held mostly not liable in a civil suit, which said that the only wrongful death was the one person on scene killed who was not a card-carrying communist at the time of his death. Now we're talking about big systems of white supremacy, right? We're talking about what are the stories we tell that demonize the people who were killed? How do we select a jury that is able to convict Klansmen and neo-Nazis? How do we issue jury instructions that adequately convey what this action was? All of those things, I realized while writing Bring the War Home, we need a bigger mechanism for understanding white supremacy than just white power. Because if it was just about racial violence, those gunmen would have been convicted in the first trial. The problem with confronting white power is that it's attached to all these other systems of inequality that have deep and long histories, and in many cases don't even need active white supremacist belief by the people arbitrating these decisions in order to continue producing inequality.
Yeah, and of course, we need to remind ourselves, this is 1979 we're talking about, not 1929. I mean, this is well within the memory of many folks. We're going to take a quick break and continue this conversation. You have such great and incisive, compelling observations to make on this subject. Dr. Kathleen Ballou, she's the co-editor of A Field Guide to White Supremacy, and we will have more with Professor Ballou on the other side of a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday Morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature Expedition through the Park School Woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Welcome back. It's an archive edition of Midday Today. I'm Tom Hall. We're listening to a conversation I had in December of 2021 with Dr. Kathleen Ballou of the University of Chicago. She's an expert in the study of extremism in the United States. We talked about her latest book, a collection of essays called A Field Guide to White Supremacy, which she edited with her University of Chicago colleague Ramon Gutierrez. The essays are by scholars and from across the spectrum of experts who study hate groups and racialized violence. A reminder, our show was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take new calls or online comments. So, Professor, we talked before the break about the distinction between white power and white supremacy. You also caution in one of your essays that white power should not be called white nationalist. We heard that term bandied about quite a bit regarding Charlottesville in 2017 and again in January of this year in the insurrection at the Capitol. How about drawing the distinction between those two terms?
Sure. So what I'm talking about when I say the white power movement is a broad coalition of groups that came together after the Vietnam War. These included Klansmen, neo-Nazis, militia groups, skinhead groups, tax protest groups, Christian identity congregations, and more. And these groups came together and in 1983 declared war on the federal government. That declaration of war is different than anything we've seen, well, arguably, but I think different than anything we've seen in prior waves of, say, the Ku Klux Klan, which has had several moments of resurgent activity in American history. What it means is that the nation in white nationalism after 1983 is not the United States. It is the Aryan nation, which these activists imagine as a transnational polity of white people. And what they argue for from that point forward is not about, you know, political office holding and sort of taking over the United States. It is about unseating the government, creating a white ethno state, and in many cases advocating for genocide of everyone that they meet who is a racial enemy, quote unquote. Now, this is a little bit more complex in the present when we see major mainstreaming of the white power movement. And we have reports about things like 8 people being elected from the January 6th insurrection into office as GOP representatives. There was a story going around about 28 people who are holders of political office who have either ties with or membership in the Oath Keepers, which is a unlawful militia group, a private army. These things tell us that this is maybe no longer as revolutionary as it once was and is sometimes interested instead in authoritarian political office holding instead. However, I think still there is a problem with the phrase white nationalism, because I think people hear white nationalism and think, oh, nationalism, that sounds like patriotism. There is nothing patriotic about any of this. This is directly anti-democracy, and it puts people who live in the United States at very great risk of violence.
So how then is it related to January 6th in the sense that you write that the violence that the white power movement advocates is to mobilize people around the world to wage a race war. You mentioned the Christian Identity group. They have transfigured this race war into a holy war in that dimension of this. But January 6th putatively was simply about the political machinations of Congress in certifying the election of President Biden. It didn't seem to be about race at that moment and at the rally that President Trump presided over prior to the riot. How are the two connected?
So I think January 6th can be best understood as the collision of 3 different strands in right-wing activism. One is simply the Trump base, which within it has a range of sort of intensity from people who were just there to attend a political rally all the way up to people who became violent that day or planned to be violent that day. The second thread is QAnon, which I think is in some ways a rehashing of an old conspiracy theory, but is operating in a way that I think is very new and very fast. And then the third strand is organized white power and militant right activism. Now, that third group is probably the smallest. An early study has shown that it is the smallest of the groups that attended on January 6th, but it's also the most organized, and in many ways, it's the most ideologically coherent of those threads. These are activists who have been training at paramilitary installations for decades, if not generations. This is the same movement that perpetrated the Oklahoma City bombing, that's been involved in anti-government action since the 1980s, that has been sort of going along, percolating its activism underground all the way from the late 1970s to its reemergence in the public sphere in Charlottesville in 2017. Same movement, in many cases, the same people, the same weapons, the same tactics, the same strategies. So it's notable that those activists showed up at January 6th not looking for a mass casualty attack, not dressed in Nazi armbands and other kinds of very intensely racist self-presentation, although, of course, there are a few exceptions to that. Mostly what we saw were militia flags, Gadsden Purchase gear, Don't Tread on Me shirts, and tactical equipment. So, for instance, when you saw the people wearing the heavy bulletproof vests going through the crowd in a line holding radios, that's an organized action. We know that white power and militant right activists are the ones who were pre-organized, who had communication between with one another on that day, that they breached the building first. And so it's worth asking what they might have thought was the point of January 6th, right? So we have one narrative that's about the event as a whole. What I'm concerned by is the repeated invocation of a white power utopian, well, dystopian novel called The Turner Diaries, which presents a sort of manual of operation and cultural lodestar for this movement and has been in play since the late 1970s. The Turner Diaries lays out an attack on the Capitol that is not a mass casualty attack, although that event appears in the book amid several other events that are mass casualty events. But instead, the attack on the Capitol and the Turner Diaries is meant to be a recruitment action. It is meant to signal that this movement can make a targeted strike even at the nation's centers of power, and that other white people will supposedly see it and awaken to the movement. Now, we know that the activists that carried out the January 6th attack behaved in this way. They did not seek out a mass casualty event. We still don't know who placed those pipe bombs, but we know that pipe bombs have been used by this movement quite a bit, not least in the Olympic Park bombing in 1996, and that pipe bombs could easily have created huge casualties on January 6th had they been used in a different way. Mostly what we saw was an event that was meant to be a recruitment and radicalization exercise. And we saw these groups immediately reach into Stop the Steal Facebook groups, into other kind of more mainstream right spaces to pull people into the white power movement. And we know that this seems to have worked. The polling numbers suggest that this was a very sympathetic event as a piece of political theater.
My guest is Dr. Kathleen Ballou from the University of Chicago, along with Ramon Gutierrez. She is the editor of a new collection of essays called A Field Guide to White Supremacy. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. So, Kathleen, I wonder, when it comes to Mr. Trump's culpability in promoting and advancing this movement, there's a chapter here in the book that traces the lineage of this sort of populist approach from Pat Buchanan to Donald Trump. So many people who are very firm supporters of former President Trump would by no means describe themselves as, you know, nationalists who are interested in overthrowing the government. And, you know, they have no aspirations that are similar to the white power movement. We're talking about suburban women and men with college educations. It's not just a bunch of non-college educated white men. We hear a lot about that demographic. How do you explain the broad support among Republicans that Mr. Trump still enjoys? And is it hurt? Is it attenuated in any way by the other side of the party being related to or associated with the white power movement?
Well, this is an interesting question that has a lot of moving parts. I mean, so one thing that we have to remember is that suburban women and college-educated men have had a home in this movement from the beginning. This is a movement that has, from its inception, been incredibly diverse in every way but race. If you think about what it takes to bring together kind of punk rock listening urban skinheads who are hard drinking and enjoying the drug scene with conservative, hyper social conservative, survivalist rural Christian housewives, there's a lot of sort of gymnastics that has to happen to make those groups feel at home with each other. And this movement has figured out how to do that very, very well. It's been online since the early 1980s, and it's been using a lot of the tools that we now see exponentially increasing in power and volume. It's been using those tools for a long time. So I think what we're seeing is just a ramping up, right? And in part, I think this is just because the Trump administration, in its attacks on our political norms, on our institutions, on our expectations, on our media circuits, has opened a window. And this is an opportunistic movement that will take advantage of any opportunity. So I think part of it is that. I think the more complex question, and the one that I hope that the January 6th Commission can begin to unravel, is where the line is between people who would like to piggyback on this current and people who are inciting, who are holding memberships, and who are interested in using this groundswell to abet authoritarian power grabs.
And you talk about the peril that we have witnessed because we have not understood some of the acts of violence as related. Thinking about the Oklahoma City bombing, which you call a culminating action of the white power movement, that happened in 1995. But thinking about Timothy McVeigh as a lone wolf, disguises how coherent and organized this movement is. So when we think of the Tree of Life synagogue attack, or the attack in Christchurch, New Zealand, the Islamophobic attack, or the attack in El Paso at the Walmart, an anti-immigrant attack. These, you say, have to be understood through the focus on these perpetrators, which makes us realize that they are part of the same story.
Yes. And I think the step beyond that is that when we talk about, you know, El Paso is anti-immigrant violence, Charleston is anti-Black violence, Pittsburgh is anti-Semitic violence, all of those kinds of racial violence have their own distinct history, their own distinct place in the long story of the United States. All of those communities have a reason to think of these as singular events. But when we foreground the focus on perpetrators, one thing that I think is really important is that all of those communities have something in common because they've all been attacked by the same thing. And there is a way that is all of us after January 6th. Our democracy, our institutions were attacked on January 6th. And I think that possibility for coalition, I think, is very hopeful. Those communities don't all share the same access to media representation, to money, to different kinds of sort of notions of appropriate victimhood. So I think that coalition building is one powerful tool that we have as we seek to address this problem moving forward.
And one of the reasons you say that we didn't anticipate, for example, Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing, even though there were the John Birch Society and there were other reasons to take note, is that it is a leaderless movement. It is cell-style terror as opposed to hierarchical-style terror. And that was a purposeful move on the part of the White Power movement because they were concerned about informants who infiltrated like the Ku Klux Klan and other groups. I mean, this was strategic in their part to not be a centrally organized movement.
Yes, absolutely. They adopted that strategy in 1983, the same year they declared war on the federal government. And it's called leaderless resistance, but it's worth noting that that doesn't mean that there are not leaders who can be prosecuted. What it means is that there's not supposed to be communication between cells and leaders or between cells and other cells. And as you said, this was implemented because they were frustrated by infiltration by security operatives, and it was thought also that it would make it easier to avoid prosecution in court. And it did do both of those things. But I think the larger legacy, the more catastrophic outcome of leaderless resistance has been that we have lost sight of this as a movement. And that's what allowed it to persist so long and to reemerge the way it did in Charlottesville with the consequences that we're now seeing as being so disastrous to so many of us.
And what about the verdict in the Charlottesville trial that just came down a week or so ago, $26 million judgment. Will mm-hmm. this cripple people like, you know, Richard Spencer and other, you know, neo-Nazis and white power people? What do you think the effect will be?
So as a historian, I have to say my little spiel about I can't predict what will happen. I need an archive to draw conclusions. But I think what we know from the historical record is that civil suit verdicts can be incredibly useful tools in limiting the spread of white power action and also in stopping momentum. So civil suits in the past have done things ranging from stopping white power activists from speaking with and communicating with each other to taking away material resources. There was one case in the late 1980s where the court found for the mother of the victim, and she got title to the Klan headquarters. They can do huge things like that. Whereas for many different reasons, you know, largely because of the way that white supremacy is built into our legal system, our criminal courts have not been as successful generally. So a civil verdict is one really great tool. Also, the finding in Charlottesville is encouraging in that it does not send a signal that additional action like Unite the Right should be the mode that these activists pursue going forward. So the other piece of information from the historical record is that when there is a big acquittal, activists often repeat that action thinking like, okay, this is the one that evades the court. So those two pieces of news are good. The problem that we now must look out for, and this has been articulated really beautifully by Joe Lowndes, who's the scholar who wrote that Buchanan to Trump chapter that you cited. He has argued, and others have noticed, that what that means is that the shift will be away from neo-Nazi and Klan symbology, which has now been prosecuted, towards more ambiguous militia presentation like what we saw on January 6th. The decision to come to that action, not wearing Nazi armbands and Klan insignia, shows us that that shift was already in play, and Charlottesville will push it along. The verdict will very likely push it in that same direction. I think that one is harder in many ways to confront because of the place that militias hold in our shared sort of narrative of the founding of the United States, even though these militia groups we're talking about now do not have a historical continuity with our founding militias. The ones we're talking about now are entirely extra-legal. They are unlawful private armies that do not have a place in those founding documents.
And the statue of Robert E. Lee that was at the center of the Unite the Right rally, it should be noted, I think yesterday the Charlottesville City Council voted to melt the statue down and create a new piece of art from that material. So we'll see what they come up with there. We're going to take a quick break. My guest is Dr. Kathleen Ballou from the University of Chicago, along with Ramon Gutierrez. She's the editor of a new collection of essays called A Field Guide to White Supremacy. We'll talk more about it on the other side of this break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, this is an encore edition of Midday. We're listening to a conversation about white extremism and the rise of the alt-right with Dr. Kathleen Ballou, whose 2018 book, Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America, traces the lineage of paramilitarism in the United States back to the Vietnam War and chronicles how the movement grew in subsequent years. Back in December of 2021, Dr. Ballou and I talked about her most recent book, a collection of essays by leading scholars that she edited along with a professor emeritus at the University of Chicago, Ramon Gutierrez. It examines different dimensions of white extremism. It's called A Field Guide to White Supremacy. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we aren't able to take any new calls or online comments. So let me ask you, Kathleen, about this distinction between white power and the alt-right. That's another distinction that you mention in your essay. How should we think about those two issues?
So scholars have long talked about, should we create a label for the thing we study, or should we use the language that people call themselves? And I tend to think that what people call themselves is usually what we should say. And in fact, that's where white power comes from, is that was the label that this movement gave itself in the 80s. Alt-right is a little bit different because it seeks to deliberately minimize the extremism and violence of the position. So I don't like that term because I think it is disingenuous. I also think that as a term, it has already sort of had its 15 minutes and isn't really in use in the way that is productive. White power isn't perfect either. I think white power as a term is probably more historical than present day, but I think it is more evocative of what this actually is and what it seeks to accomplish.
We have an email from a listener, Christopher, who says, how did people like Vladimir Putin or the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban come to be such important figures to these far-right extremist movements? And how do they continue to hold sway? What do you think the fascination is with folks like that?
I think that's a great question. And I think we won't have the full answer on that one until somebody gets into the archive and looks at what happened between 1996 and 2017. For me, I think this is the shadowiest part of the story because it sits right between the, it's sort of like the gap between the historical materials that are available and what we can see unfolding in real time. So that's always for historians kind of the unknown piece. We historians like to work with lots and lots of papers. So to get the wide view that allowed me to look at Bring the War Home, which is, I think, important because the wide view lets you see not only what people say they're doing and believe, but what they're actually doing. And to get there, we need big piles of paper. We need declassified FBI documents. We need court transcripts. We need people leaving the movement and testifying against others. We need autobiographies. We need all kinds of paper to figure out what exactly was going on. We don't have that kind of paper for post-1996, partly because the movement was relocated online and partly because it was becoming even more transnational than it already was. Things were moving around in a completely different way. So I would love to know the answer to that question, and I'm not satisfied that we have it yet.
We have a caller on the line, Clarence from Baltimore. Clarence, welcome to Midday with Dr. Kathleen Ballou.
Thank you for taking the call. Doctor, I'd like to ask a question about Congressman Massey's posting of a Christmas card online with his entire family banishing automatic weapons. Do you see a nexus or a connection between your topic, which what we're talking about today, and the posting of that picture, because it symbolizes to me something more than just the right to own weapons or something like that. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I think one of the ways to think about this is that we in the United States have a evident problem with gun violence, partly because we're not just talking about the right to own a gun. We're talking about an escalating right to own weapons and other kinds of violent apparatuses that are exponentially more effective as time progresses. So brandishing an automatic weapon or a semi-automatic weapon is different than brandishing a muzzle-loading weapon that we would have seen earlier in our nation's history. And I think that reasonable people can agree that there have been changes in how effective armament is. The other component is that the use of weapons has dramatically changed even since the 1990s. When I was writing Bring the War Home, there were laws on the books that people used over and over again to limit this kind of activity, like, for instance, using a law against assembling a private army and parading in public with firearms was used to stop Klan intimidation of Vietnamese immigrants in Texas in the late 70s and early 80s. Those laws have really both not been enforced and have been rolled back by things like open carry. And the impact is intimidation against various kinds of people, usually targeted outgroups. So I think there is a complex and very important set of issues here that we need to think about, not least because when militias turn up, and militias, again, we should think of as unlawful private armies, they often turn up saying that they're there to keep order and actually having exactly the opposite impact. So we could think again of the militia groups that were on scene at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. And they were so heavily armed, according to Governor at the time, Terry McAuliffe, that police couldn't respond to protect counter demonstrators because the militias outgunned the local police. That is not law or order. That is chaos and private armies taking over the function of those policing actions.
And we appreciate that call, Clarence. And listeners, if you haven't seen the photograph that Clarence is referring to, this is Representative Thomas Massie. He's a congressman from Kentucky. He's got a photograph of his family in front of a Christmas tree. It's their holiday card, evidently. There are five children and his wife, and they're all holding these very vicious-looking weapons. And of course, this was posted just a few days after the school shooting in Michigan. So people thought that the inappropriateness of it notable on any number of levels. One of the other essays in this book, many of the essays I just thought were incredible, and unfortunately we don't have time to talk about a lot of them, but your co-editor, Ramon Gutierrez, wrote an essay called A Recent History of White Supremacy, and he notes that in the GI Bill, when that bill was passed, people applauded it as a sort of, you know, race-neutral government program, but in fact, it was changed before it was actually voted into law so that it was administered by individual states. And that's one of the things that led to the fact that people of color were disenfranchised and not given access to the benefits of the GI Bill. And this is one of several essays. There's another wonderful essay by a professor from Princeton University, Professor, I'm terrible on the names. I have it here in my notes somewhere. Kianga Yamada Taylor. The culture of racism. These things really are inextricably bound when we talk about this white power movement because of the history and the legacy of racism in our country.
Exactly. And I think those two essays together really do show how some of these hidden systems are still at play, even if you live in a community where everyone you know is interested in dismantling white supremacy, you're still sort of in the position of being a beneficiary in many cases. So Kianga Yamada Taylor's book, and that essay is the excerpted first chapter of her award-winning book, Race for Profit, which is all about inequality in Black property ownership and the accumulation of capital. And then Ramon is just a brilliant scholar and thinker who really traces the interplay between these different major historical events like the GI Bill, drawing on some of the best scholarship out there in order to sort of show how deeply inequality has run in structuring our society. And I think those are really important things to keep in mind as we move about the world.
We just have another minute left here. One of the reasons we have not been able to anticipate some of this violence that we've witnessed, and we're surprised by it, not only this leaderless resistance that you mentioned earlier, but a number of times that people have tried to convict people of these crimes and failed. But also, the third reason you say is the large-scale and durable forgetting of everything we know about white power activism. In our final minute, what do we need to make sure we remember?
This is happening at hyperspeed now about January 6th. The concerted effort to wipe out what we all saw that day with our own eyes and to distort the facts of that moment into just another tourist visit, as one person said, are stunning and so fast. And I know this is a big ask in a moment when people have a million impossible stories to pay attention to, but if you can keep eyes on this and keep reading about it and keep your attention on it, I really think that's one powerful tool we have in combating organized white power activism.
And this book is a great place to start. It's called A Field Guide to White Supremacy. Dr. Kathleen Belew, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to an encore presentation of Midday. To hear any of our shows at any time, subscribe to our podcast or come to our website, wipr.org/midday. To follow us on Twitter, it's @MiddayWIPR. To follow me, it's @TomHall, WIPR. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.